The merciful love of Jesus. The text is the Gospel of John, chapter 8, verses 2 through 11. Speaking of Jesus, it says, "At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, 'Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?'" That's how this next glimpse into the multifaceted love of Jesus begins. This is a very big moment in his life and ministry, and the stakes are very high indeed. At the time, Jesus has been teaching in the temple courts. He's surrounded by a crowd of onlookers, and the Pharisees have just interrupted this pleasant gathering by presenting to Jesus a carefully crafted trap. And what Jesus says next is going to have such impact that his words will echo through the ages. So let's take a step back and consider the context of this conflict. In the first installment of this series, The Heroic Love of Jesus, we explored how Jesus dared to heal a man with a crippled hand on the Sabbath day, knowing full well that if he did, the Pharisees would want to kill him. And from that day on, they've been plotting against him, asking him questions designed only to trap him so they might find a reason to discredit him. And apparently they learn of this woman caught in the act of adultery, and they're all excited because they think they might be able to use her crime against him. On the face of it, the Pharisees do seem to have a case. In Leviticus chapter 20, verse 10, the law of Moses did call adultery a capital offense, but did not mandate stoning in particular. But that was a law for the nation of Israel, and Israel is now under Roman rule. And under Roman rule, only Roman courts could sentence a person to death. Besides, theologians throughout the ages have agreed that the kingdom Jesus was ushering in is a gentler, more merciful kingdom than the kingdom of Israel under the law of Moses. God hasn't changed, but the coming of Jesus changed everything for the people of God and changed them for the better. From the book of Genesis onward, God has been progressively revealing himself to humanity. As the Gospel of John chapter 1, verse 17 says, "The law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ." So when we read the Old Testament, we learn much about God, particularly about his justice. But in the New Testament and in Jesus, we learn so much more about God's grace and mercy and love. And as the Son of God and Messiah, Jesus had the authority to make changes in the law. I don't want to get sidetracked by a lot of theology of Old Testament life versus New Testament life. My point is, the Pharisees' argument that she must be stoned was from another time and another dispensation. But setting aside such theological arguments, as we picture this scene in our mind's eye, we have to take a step back and ask, what's wrong with this picture? Because something is very, very wrong. Well, first of all, where is the man? Where's the man she's supposed to have committed adultery with? Last time I checked, it takes two to tango, and it takes two to commit adultery. The man was equally guilty under the law and faced the same penalty as the woman. So where is the man? Very interesting that the Pharisees did not produce him or subject him to the same humiliation and shame. He might be from a prominent family. They might have wealth. We know that the Pharisees loved money because Luke chapter 16, verse 14 says that. So the man or the family of the man may very well have paid them off to save his life and reputation. Such things were not unusual. But the woman, evidently she has no money. She has no family protecting her. She has no influence to speak of. She has no special interest group advocating for her. If she had, this would not be happening to her. So she stands there, and she stands there alone. So there is injustice at the core of this spectacle, gross injustice. In addition to this, Jesus knows that they're only using this poor woman to get at him. They are using her, a further injustice. The Pharisees were very protective about their own honor and reputation, but they seem to care very little for the reputation of others. They don't mind using this woman to further their goals, and they don't even see any wrong in it. So self-important they are. Who is she to them? Nothing. She's only meaningful to the degree that she can be used to further their own dark purposes. The Pharisees think they can use her to discredit Jesus, and use her they will. The whole thing is disturbingly sick and perverse. But that is who these men are. Self-serving, self-important, loving their power over the people. And there they are, standing proud behind this woman, asking Jesus, "What then do you say?" And there is nothing genuine about this inquiry. Verse 6 says they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. They really think they've outfoxed Jesus this time. Because if he says, "No, don't stone her," the Pharisees plan to say, "See, he has no respect for the law of Moses. He's a lawbreaker. Therefore, he cannot be from God." And if he says, "Yes, stone the woman," well, he not only violates Roman law, but he violates his own purpose. For Jesus had said, "God did not send his son into the world to condemn the world, but to save the world through him." That's John 3:17. Plus, the Pharisees would like nothing more than to drive a wedge between Jesus and the people who love him for his mercy. If he chooses one way, they will say he's too lenient. Another, and they will say he's too harsh. It's a game of gotcha, like the game reporters play with politicians they don't like. And the temple courts are full of people all watching this, and they're all straining to hear Jesus' response. And the Pharisees are all standing there, probably with smug grins on their faces as they wait for Jesus to fall into their trap. But Jesus doesn't fall into it. Instead, it says, "But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger." No one records what he wrote, so I won't speculate. But what's important is that Jesus pauses to reflect. And we should learn something from that. We don't need to answer everything immediately, especially when asked questions of consequence. So often merely difficult things are turned into catastrophic things because we react in emotion. But here, Jesus just writes on the ground. In the meantime, the suspense is building. What's Jesus going to do? Does Jesus, like the Pharisees, use this moment and use this woman to further his agenda? Oh, far from considering how he can exploit this. He cares about the woman as a person, not as a means to an end. At every step of Jesus' life, he puts the interests of others ahead of his own. That is his very nature, and that's the very meaning of love. The Pharisees want to use her. Jesus wants to save her. He had said in Luke chapter 6, verse 37, "Do not judge, and you will not be judged. Do not condemn, and you will not be condemned." And he said in Matthew chapter 7, verse 3, "Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? First, take the plank out of your own eye, then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." So now, what he does next is in perfect harmony with his teachings. Verse 7, "When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, 'Let him who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her.'" What? What a stunning turn of events. They were so sure they had trapped him. They had talked to each other and told each other how this is going to bring Jesus down. then Jesus speaks, and his words are like a tiny pinprick on a big balloon. And as they stood there, you could almost hear the air gently hissing out. There's no answer from the Pharisees. No retort, no objection, no debate, nothing. Nothing but a gentle hiss. Then it says, again, he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Jesus had answered. And he answered in a way that not only saved the woman, but completely turned the argument around and took the spotlight off her and put it on her very accusers, her judges. Oh, I'm sure the first thoughts that entered their minds were flashbacks of their own shameful acts. Oftentimes, the very people who are quickest to point to the sins of others have the darkest secrets, and all that sin-shaming of others is just camouflage for their own shame. As theologian Matthew Henry says in his commentary about this passage, it is common for those who are indulgent to their own sin to be severe against the sins of others. So it says, verse 9, at this, those who heard began to go away one at a time. And notice, next it says, the older ones went away first. They are the ones who had a lifetime to do many shameful things. The young Pharisees linger. They probably think there's still more to be said. But the old guys know that the debate is over and that they've lost. They probably can't get out of there fast enough. His response had diffused the conflict, and they go away. They all go away. Then it says, until only Jesus was left with the woman still standing there. Verse 10, Jesus straightened up and asked, woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you? No one, sir, she said. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared. Go now and leave your life of sin. He saves her from condemnation, but he does not excuse her adultery. He says, leave it. Sin is destructive in its nature, and some sins are more destructive than others. Adultery is one of those particularly destructive sins. But sin, in whatever form it takes, is not our friend. Sin, like Satan himself, desires only to steal, kill, and destroy. So Jesus addresses it. But he addresses it not with condemnation, but with love and compassion. And he has that same love and compassion and restoration for each of us this morning, to the degree that we have need of it. In conclusion, it's easy for people who love only themselves to celebrate the condemnation of others, that they might look all the better in comparison. But Jesus, whose overarching quality is love, is far more interested in the restoration of the sinner than the punishment of the sin. So we should be likewise. And let us always remember those four simple yet profound words of James chapter 2, verse 13. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Pass me not, O gentle Savior, hear my humble cry. While on others thou art calling, do not pass me by. Savior, Savior, hear my humble cry. While on others thou art calling, do not pass me by. Let me at thy throne of mercy find a sweet relief. Kneeling there in deep contrition, help my unbelief. Savior, Savior, hear my humble.
cry, while on others thou art calling. Do not pass me by, trusting only in thy merit. Would I seek thy face, heal my wounded, broken spirit. Save me by thy grace, Savior, Savior, hear my humble cry, while on others thou art calling, do not pass me by, thou the spring of all my comfort. More than life to me, whom have I on earth beside thee, whom in heaven but thee? Savior, Savior, hear my humble cry, while on others thou art calling, do not pass me by, while